In this episode of Flexible Elements with Per Jobourg, we talk with Michael Rubenstein of Harvard University about building, managing, and controlling 1,024 robots, the current world record, from IT Conversations. Hi, this is Phil Windley, the executive producer of IT Conversations. Today I'm excited to bring you another program from Flexible Elements with Per Jobourg.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's our program from Flexible Elements.
Welcome to the Flexibility Envelope podcast. I'm here today with Michael Rubenstein, working with Radhika Nagpal at Harvard University. He's going to talk to us about how he intends to build 1,024 robots, which is a really ambitious goal. Can you tell me a bit about the issues and challenges you were facing when you planned this project?
For designing the hardware for 1,024 robots is already kind of difficult. There's a lot of issues that on a normal robot don't really come up that when you build 1,024, they're kind of critical if you want to operate them in any time period that's relatively short.
So yeah, it's a whole new can of worms, huh?
Yeah, so I mean, in a standard robot, I always say if you turn a standard robot on, it takes a second or two to turn that on. And mm-hmm. But if you have 1,024 robots and a single person every 2 seconds turns a robot on, that takes a half hour to turn them on. So
yeah, and that's simply not isn't scalable.
And if you do more, I mean, it just becomes worse and worse. So we address that with a way to turn all the robots on at once. Mm-hmm. Other issues are,
how did you do that?
So you have the robots are in a low power sleep state, so mm-hmm. They go to sleep and they draw like 50 microamps. Mm-hmm. And
the battery will then last very
couple
long
months,
time.
Yeah, yeah. A couple months. And then whenever they wake up every minute or so and they check the infrared messages and see if they've received any messages that say turn on. Mm-hmm. They do this for a fraction of a second. And then mm-hmm. if not, they go back to sleep for mm-hmm. another minute. So if you want to turn them on, you just send a bright message to everyone that says turn on, and then you keep on sending this for a long period of time.
For a minute and 1 second, and then basically everybody is cycled through.
Sure, everyone, eventually, within a minute, everyone will have seen it and then turn on.
Mm-hmm. And the time you mentioned is basically arbitrary. It can be tailored to whatever application.
It depends on how much battery life you're willing to consume in this low power sleep state. So if you want to turn on quickly, then you're gonna pay for that with a little bit more power usage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I guess there's also like charging issues you need to handle.
Sure. On my robots, there's two metal pins. And they each have a built-in lithium ion battery and battery charger. So mm-hmm. if you put 5 volts across those two pins, then it'll automatically charge its own battery until it's full and stop charging.
Mm-hmm. So you basically walk them up to their own charger, and then they
you just have a long strip of metal, two mm-hmm. metal strips with 5 volts across it, and you just put them all on that strip. Mm-hmm. It takes a second or two each robot. So I mean, it mm-hmm. might take 20 minutes to put them all on the strip, and you leave them overnight, and they'll charge.
Yeah, and then of course they will last a long time. You could do a lot of. You don't have to charge them that often, even if you use them.
Sure.
How long do they run on battery if you continuous use, so to speak?
Like for normal, I mean, it depends on the usage of the mm-hmm. motors. Basically, the motors are the biggest power draw. So if you normal usage is about 4 hours of battery lifetime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you're just continuously using the motors at full power, it's probably about an hour or two.
Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. we could talk a little bit about the overall structure of the robot, because I think you have to really think about that also when you're supposed to build this many.
Sure.
Can you describe the structure of your robot, like how it works?
The robot is basically a small piece, a circular PCB with these three legs that are used to support the robot over the table as well as for locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a simple locomotion strategy that uses these two vibrational motors, similar to like a BristleBot.
Mm-hmm. And they can be found in shavers, in cell phones, and everywhere.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's the same. It's basically a cell phone vibrating motor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, based on which motors you turn on, you can turn the robot left counterclockwise, clockwise, or if you turn them both on, it'll go forward.
Yeah. So it's basically tank thread steering. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I chose that because it's a much simpler and cheaper mechanism for locomotion compared to...
It's easy to assemble, huh?
Yeah, it's relatively easy to assemble. You don't have to... The only thing you do is mount these vibrational motors on the chassis of the PCB. So,
because that's made with pick and place and can be made in large series without no problem.
There's only a few components that need to be hand soldered on. Mm-hmm. Those are like the legs, anything that's not SMD component. So the battery, the legs, and maybe the motors. Mm-hmm. That's it.
And I guess that you could probably somehow devise a structure that did that too if you need to make more than 1,024.
So to put the legs need a relatively precise positioning. So and their back two legs are bent. So instead of just hand bending them, you have I'll have a block of metal. You put the legs in at the right angle. It puts them in the right angle just because there's holes where the legs go. You put the PCB on top of it and you solder it, and it takes a couple of seconds to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a fixture that's normally used in industry. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really interesting. Can you talk a bit about... You also wrote control algorithms that will exploit these capabilities.
Sure. My initial work into this was for my thesis with Weiman at Weiman Shen at USC. And what I did is I have a control algorithm that you give a desired shape to all the robots in the collective. So you draw a picture of a star or something.
Yeah, whatever you want.
Yeah, as long as it's a connected shape.
Mm-hmm.
You give that to all the robots, and they move to form a tightly packed version of the shape. So if you stand back, it looks like a star, kind of like pixels in a drawing. And once they start forming the shape, they don't know how many robots are in the shape. So they have to decide, they have to figure that out, and at the same time, increase the size of the shape or decrease the size of the shape to fit the number of robots.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this fitting is always done. So if you cut the robot shape in half, then it'll reduce the size of the shape until it's, again, proportional to the number of robots. So
it's
a self-healing capability.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing in modular robotics and self-reconfiguring modular robotics, that they can actually heal and even self-heal. They'll just discover that I'm not what I'm supposed to be. Let's rearrange ourselves so that we at least come as close as possible. Huh?
Sure, that's one of the advantages of a self-reconfigurable robot.
Yeah, yeah, and that's one of the goals we're striving for. Huh? So that's really interesting. The cost is also important.
Sure.
Did you calculate the cost? And
when you're building 1,024 robots, every penny you spend on your robot ends up being $10 for the entire collective. So it's very important to find the cheapest components you can. So for instance, the entire robot itself costs $12 and like 30 cents or something. And that's broken into like the power system, which is the most expensive part, is a lithium ion battery, and the battery charger, which is about $3 or so. The locomotion, which is just the two vibrational motors, is the main part of the locomotion. That's under $2. We use an Atmel microprocessor, the Atmega 168. That's under $3 for 1,000 of those components. The infrared communication system cost under $2, and then I budgeted in about $2 for building the PCB and assembling the SMD components.
I think that you also would could optimize this further if you decided that, okay, now we're going to do a production robots for some kind. Then you could probably push this even further. But when you use the components you do now, I guess you're basically at cost.
Sure, yeah. I mean, when you buy 1,000 of any component, they start to be pretty close to the minimum cost that you can purchase this then, purchase the components for.
So drop the price even more, you had to start to design each component, each piece by piece to be simpler and cheaper.
Yeah, well, I've already done that, I think, so I don't know how much cheaper I could make it.
So this is what we see now, and it's still fascinating that you can build a robot for $12. And
I spent a lot of time trying to make it as cheap as possible.
Yeah,
like, most of the components are the cheapest I can find, and the communication system is relatively cheap. Just uses a simple op amp and some resistors and stuff like that, so it's relatively cheap already.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you're going to try to make these shapes and show that they can shrink and grow, and that they will also transform from one shape to another by loading a different program.
That's possible. I'm not sure if I'm planning on doing that or not. But if you give them a shape, they'll form that shape. So if you can have a way of switching between shapes, that will work also.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be really cool to see them transform from one shape to another, because that is self-reconfiguring.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, even, I guess, self-assembly can be considered self-reconfiguring, because you start from this random shape and you form the desired shape. So it's kind of self-reconfiguring already.
I guess for the algorithm, it doesn't really matter whether they actually physically form a physical bond or just arrange themselves close enough to each other.
Sure. So with the way I'm doing it with simple mobile robots is the simplest way. Once you start adding connectors and stuff like that, it becomes a more constrained problem. So I figure I'd start with the simplest one first.
Yeah, you have to start in that end then. But I think that your navigational, the precision you navigate with is reasonably high, I understand.
Yeah, so the only sensor on board is a infrared sensor that measures the distance between the neighboring robots, and that has an accuracy of about a millimeter.
For what we're talking about, $12 and such a simple system, this is very impressive. Huh?
And that's, you know, a fraction of the radius of a robot. So it's basically like knowing precisely the distance between your neighbors.
For the
range that
it works well enough for what you're trying to achieve. Huh?
Yeah.
So what's the future like now? You have accomplished the first. You're irritated through a few prototypes.
Sure.
And what are you going to do now?
So I'm almost to the point where I'm happy with the design of the robots. And once I'm happy with it, I will build about 25 or so, just a small production run, and try just to ensure that all the algorithms I was thinking will work on them actually does work. And once I'm happy with that, we'll go ahead and build the full collective and implement some collective behavior, such as the stuff I did in my thesis.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool, because it's the first time we see anything above 200 units, I think. It's the first time we see a true swarm robot, that because the other swarms have been, like you say, maybe 10 or 15 or 25 units.
And those are kind of, you know, ant foraging algorithms, where this is a tightly packed configuration. I think it would be interesting, because for the first time for me, it'll be where you kind of step back and you don't really see the individual robots in the collective. You just see
The emergent shape, so
sure,
to speak.
Yeah,
that's gonna be great. What kind of time frame are we talking about?
I'm hoping to get this done in a year or two, so hopefully.
Because you haven't been working with what you, except for the algorithm, which was your thesis, the building of the robot hasn't taken that long time,
it's
I
been
understand.
Been maybe 4 months or so that I've been actually building these robots and designing them.
Progress,
Well, they're simple robots, so.
Yeah, but that's also, they're simple by design. You made them simple, and we realized all these problems. And I wonder if we're not going to see some new interesting problems appear when you do the 25, and I'm sure we're going to see lots of interesting bases for further research when you do the 1024.
I hope I thought of all the problems, but I haven't. So.
No. And that's what research is about. It's solving the problems you know about and discovering new ones.
Sure, yes.
Have you, for instance, thought any about, I mean, when you do these shapes, a robot or two will, of course, stop to work properly. It might behave irrationally. It may just break and it won't do anything. What will happen then with the algorithm?
I haven't designed any algorithm that works when the robots are intentionally trying to make the algorithm fail. However, if a robot just turns off or stops moving, the collective as a whole doesn't really interact with each other. The robots don't interact with each other too much. The most interaction they do is
bump into each other.
Well, a large percentage of the interaction is physically bumping into each other. So if the robot fails, you can still bump into it and it's fine.
But how will it... There's probably two things we'll see in the future research. What happens when one of them just stops? It would be a fixed point in this, more or less fixed. It won't move actively anyway. And then, of course, the crazy robot that just does whatever it does.
So, I mean, the shape will form on top of all those things happening. So if there's a fixed robot, that robot will stay fixed in the shape. If it's in the shape, it'll stay in the shape. If it's outside the shape, it'll just stay there. So you have the shape forming, and if there's a crazy robot running around, it won't really affect the shape itself.
No, it will move around within the shape.
Or outside the shape.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's like if the algorithm that I use is basically like saying, if you want to form a circle, you have a bunch of people go as close to a point as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So if some of those people aren't behaving properly,
they'll just,
everyone's still trying to go close to the point. So
yeah, there's so many of them that this is going to blend into the whole. Sure. Yeah, that's really interesting.
I think it's fairly robust to those type of failures. I'm not sure about the failures where you're intentionally trying to deceive your neighbors or anything like that.
Okay. Interesting research, because that, of course, touches on a problem that in the future is going to be really important for both modular and self-reconfiguring and swarm robotics, and that's, of course, safety, so that the user can depend on the fact that the solution is going to do what it intends to do and cannot be manipulated from the outside. So
sure. Yeah.
Probably some interesting research to do there.
We're trying to get it to be to the point where you need safety right now. you know you need it right now.
Yeah, and I think that and when you... when you have this platform, I think many people will be able to do a lot of interesting research based on it. Huh?
Sure, yeah. We're not trying to keep the platform secret. So no. Once we have it working in a working form, we're going to be able to give that to other groups to look
at. Yeah, and many groups will be able to buy it too, because it's reasonably cheap. Huh?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, then we have the hard problem. This is 2D. Do you think we're going to see something in 3D over the... reasonably close time, or is it that really hard problem?
So, I mean, the reason I did 2D is, first of all, the algorithm that I have will work in 3D. But the hard part is building the hardware to do 3D.
But
so
the algorithm, if we prove the algorithm for 2D, we have a strong indication that it will work in 3D too.
I'm fairly confident that it will work in 3D.
Yeah,
There's no, I don't think there's any reason why it shouldn't. Mm-hmm. The main problem I'm doing, the reason I'm doing it in 2D is just for the easy implementation of the robot. So
yeah, simplicity. Yeah. 3D is a very complex problem.
Yeah, whether you're in a liquid, or if you're trying to have flying robots, or they're climbing over each other, even climbing over other robots is very complicated. You need these special way to climb over other robots. It's not simple.
Mm-hmm.
Where this is, everyone's on this flat surface that's very predictable.
Yeah, yeah. And if that verifies the basic algorithm, just fine. You don't have to add all that unnecessary complexity.
Sure, yeah.
So that was really great to talk to you, and we're really going to follow this project, and we hope to see that cool video of the star forming. And I'm going to link to the papers and other videos in the show notes so our listeners can check them out, and I really think they should. And it's going to be really cool to see them in practice sometime soon.
Okay.
So thank you for being with us, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Joborg.
The Conversations Network is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we need your help. For a tax-deductible donation of as little as $5 per month, you can support this channel and the rest of the Conversations Network. So please visit conversationsnetwork.org to become a member and help us continue to bring our programs to the world for free. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media. The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mike Seifried. Our website editor was Joel Cherney. The series producer is Joel Cherney.
This is Phil Wendley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Flexible Elements with Per Joborg here on IT Conversations.